New York! Global! Game Jam! Woo!
I imagine there are probably some people in the room that are a little apprehensive or cautious about the idea of having a story in a game that you also need to make within 26 hours, and that is fair. I get that, because most of the time when we think of the idea of story in games, the first thing we think of is games with a lot of story and a lot of writing. There's like pages and pages of characters and plots and plot twists and romance material and all that stuff, and that's fair, because most games nowadays have some aspect of that, especially console and PC releases have a lot of that. And I'm a writer, I love games with a lot of writing, with a lot of good writing. But ultimately, writing isn't really the core of storytelling in games. Writing is extra. The basis of storytelling in games is really about the gameplay and about the human emotional context that's surrounding the gameplay. Unless a game is entirely abstract, like checkers, like Tetris, most games symbolize some kind of human scenario that means something to your player on an emotional level. So like one game that I'm going to be talking about a lot today is a board game called Forbidden Island. And Forbidden Island does not have a plot. There's no specific sequence of events that happens every time the player plays through Forbidden Island. There is no dialogue. But it does have human emotional context around what's happening and why it's important. Like the story of Forbidden Island is about a group of treasure hunters, the players, who come to Forbidden Island in order to gather all of the treasure on the island and escape before the island sinks into the ocean and disappears. Now, it's entirely possible to play this game without any of that human context. Every single game works in and of itself on a mechanical, mathematical level. But when there is human context around the game, it alters the player's experience with it. Like, I, now when I play Forbidden Island, get to participate in the fantasy of being a treasure hunter. And what's important about this is it actually affects the way that players play the game, because it can help the way that they feel while playing the game and inspire them to make different decisions. So this is really the basics of storytelling in game design, is what does the gameplay mean to us on an emotional level? We can do more than that, but we don't have to. So in the spirit of that, I'm going to sort of divide my time up into two halves. The first thing we're going to be talking about is this: how do we create human context around gameplay? How do we do that in a strategic way where it actually affects the design of the game and the way players play it? And then in the second half, I'm going to sort of talk about what happens if we want to do a little bit extra, what happens if we do want some dialogue, a specific plot, and how can we fit that into what's probably going to end up being like a 5 to 10 minute gameplay experience. It's probably going to end up being pretty short because we don't have a lot of time to work on it. On that note, when I teach, I tend to give a little too much information a little too quickly, and I do that consciously. I would rather have you guys leave going, "Oh my god, that was a lot really fast," than have you guys leave going, "He didn't answer my question." So if I say something that is unfamiliar, don't feel bad about raising your hand and asking me to slow down and speak the Queen's English. That's okay. I will 100% forget what I'm talking about, but then we'll all go on an adventure together of me remembering what I'm talking about. Cool? Awesome. So, painting your mechanics in human context. The key to doing this well is you want to make sure your gameplay mechanics, the actual rules of your game, and the context are woven together. They're actually connected. What we don't want to do is we don't want to pick any scenario that we think sounds cool and then paste it over gameplay we've already developed. Like, one horrible example of what we totally shouldn't do is we could make Forbidden Island zombie themed, because like the hand of God is not going to reach down and stop us. So we could make all of the players like different types of zombies. We can make the treasure that the player is after like the shotgun and the chainsaw. We can do that, but ultimately that's going to be a problem because this gameplay doesn't fit a zombie scenario. It doesn't behave like a zombie scenario. It doesn't feel like zombies when you play the game. And when we paste any scenario we want over our game, but ultimately the player is going to get confused. Like, what will happen in this situation is the player will sit down expecting to play a zombie-style game, and the gameplay won't behave the way that they think it should. So they will have a difficult time learning and understanding the game because we painted it in the wrong light when they first saw it. So what we want to do is we want to connect this to our mechanics, which means we actually want to go through our different types of mechanics one by one and connect each specific aspect of our game to the scenario. We want to look at this particular aspect of the way our game behaves and go, okay, how does this fit into the scenario? When I'm doing this, and I'm primarily a storyteller, so I know designers who think about mechanics in other ways. I know designers who think about mechanics in groups of like 8 different types of mechanics. I know people who think about them in 3. I think about them in 5. And I want to go through, figure out what group this mechanic sort of fits into and how I want to fit this into the context of my story. So first, I want to think about what the goal of the game is. What does the player have to do in order to achieve a victory, and what's the human context behind why they want to do that? Why do the characters in the story of the game want to do this, and what emotional attachment does the player already have to it when they start playing the game? I will put that into an example. Let's talk about Forbidden Island again. The goal of Forbidden Island is about gathering treasure. I, David, as a human being, already have an emotional attachment to the idea of treasure when I sit down to play the game. I am familiar with the book Treasure Island. I went on treasure hunts when I was a kid. I have an emotional attachment to that idea before I sit down to start playing the game. When we have a more elongated plot, when we have a lot of writing, we can build up the player's emotional attachment in something that they don't already have emotional attachment to, but when we are using our story this way, our story is there to provide a bit of purpose to the gameplay mechanics. We're not building up their emotional attachments. We want to pick something that they already care about. Does that idea make sense? Mm-hmm. Cool. So once we've figured out, once we've thought a little bit about the goal of the game, how does the player win, we want to move on to all of the different objects that are in the game world. And I do mean physical objects like character avatars, obstacles, enemies, guns, bullets, all of the physical things. But I also mean non-physical things. Like HP, as an example. If HP is a thing in our game, what does that mean on a human level? Is it representing the character's physical health like it normally does? Is it representing the character's emotional health? Is it representing the health of something that's off-screen far away? What are all of these objects? Why are they here in this scenario, and why do they behave the way that they do? Next, we want to talk about actions. What are all of the different actions available both to the player and to the artificial intelligence of the game? Why do certain objects behave differently than others? Why are some actions available to some objects and not to others? Next, the space of the game. Where is all of this happening? Why do some areas in the game behave differently than other areas in the game? And when I'm thinking about rules, just for the sake of this, just for the sake of putting a human face on everything, I oversimplify rules, and I think about them as complications in the relationships between the other types of mechanics. Why are some actions available to some objects and not others? Why are some objects able to enter some spaces when other objects aren't able to enter that? What are the relationships between these objects, actions, and spaces, and why do these complications exist? We're going to keep talking about this. That's going to become more clear, but have I spoken English so far? Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, I want to reiterate, it's really important, that all storytelling in games is, by definition, optional. It is totally possible to have a completely abstract game like Tetris where nothing is connected to any sort of human scenario, and this isn't an all-or-nothing scenario. We don't have to decide between Tetris or The Last of Us. We can take our stories seriously and sort of vary in different degrees. So, going back to Forbidden Island again as an example, most of the mechanics in this game are connected to the story that's happening, but not all of them are. Like, one mechanic that is connected is the idea that different players have different movement patterns and abilities. Like, the pilot character can fly anywhere he wants to on the map once per turn, whereas the explorer character can move diagonally, whereas the other characters are set to only move in the cardinal directions. The ability of each different character is explained by that character's identity and their backstory in the actual story. That mechanic is connected. One that is not is the idea of the different cards in the game. In order to collect a treasure, like let's say we were going to collect the blue chalice treasure, right? In order to collect that treasure, one player needs to have 4 blue chalice cards. They then need to move on to one of the 2 spaces in which they can claim that treasure, and they need to exchange the cards for the treasure. the object of the card mechanic, and none of the actions around claiming the treasure are explained in the context of the story. Like, there is no, you're reading through the player manual, and you realize, oh, in order to claim the treasure, we need to open the chest, which requires 4 keys. Like, no, that's just how the game works. And that's okay. Like, it is okay in Super Mario Brothers that none of us really has a clear picture of how a mushroom makes an Italian man suddenly double in size. It's okay to have varying levels of abstraction in our game. It's about sort of finding the right feel for your game. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So, when we decide that we do want to connect a mechanic to our context, we want that explanation to serve a specific purpose. We do not want to have an explanation for the sake of having an explanation. That is sometimes okay when you are building a world, when you are building a more elaborate story, but right now we're really focusing on our gameplay mechanics. We want this mechanic to serve the player experience when interacting purely with the mechanics. So, go on a journey, let's say we're all making Super Mario Brothers, and we have a specific object of a fire flower, and we decide we want to connect this object to sort of the lore of what's happening. And we come up with some elaborate backstory of, like, the fire flower was developed by a mad scientist in the Flower Kingdom and brought over to the Mushroom Kingdom by ship. And in the Mushroom Kingdom, it has no natural enemies, and so the fire flower flourished, and that's why it's everything. Like, great, but that doesn't affect my relationship with the actual gameplay, and we really don't have an overarching scenario for this specific game. So, like, it's alright that we have that, but utterly it's extraneous. And so, in game design, it's probably going to be removed. Yes?
So, something that would make sense in that case would be, like, if you hover over the firefly, it says select firefly and you want to speed up. Is that helpful for gameplay then?
Explaining the purpose of mechanic. That is one of the things we're going to talk about, is we can use story to teach the different game going on. So we'll get there in a second.
Yeah.
Cool. So when we do have an explanation, when we are connecting these two things together, we want our explanation to serve a design purpose. So for the sake of this game jam, I would say when you are connecting a specific type of mechanic to the context of your story, try and have that explanation accomplish one of three different goals. First, we can create an emotional experience for the player, beyond their competitive desire to win. Second, the narrative context of a mechanic can help explain its purpose, can help the player learn and remember what that mechanic does and how it behaves. And then lastly, we can use the narrative context of a mechanic to appeal directly to the type of player that you want to play your game. I'm going to go through these one by one and give examples and talk about how we do that. So the first one, let's say we want our narrative context to create a very emotional experience. We still don't necessarily want a plot, a specific sequence of events with a lot of writing, but we still want our gameplay to be emotional on some level. I'm going to give you an example of a game that does that really well, and then we're going to talk after we have the example about how we do it, so we're all on the same page. A game that does this very well is a game called Plague Inc. It is a mobile game that has done very well for itself, in large part because it is such an emotionally compelling experience. The idea of Plague Inc. is that you, the player, play as a disease, and your goal is to wipe out every single human being on the planet. It is a goal that you have strong emotional attachments to. Not necessarily positive emotional attachments, but you have a strong emotional investment in the goal of that game. Now, in Plague Inc., you do this a little indirectly. You do not directly control who catches your disease and when. Instead, you play the game by upgrading your disease and mutating in specific ways. You spend DNA points, which is basically like your upgrade pool, on specific mutations. You can create new symptoms, like coughing and rashes and internal organ failure. And you can purchase new transmissions, new ways your disease is transmitted, like blood-to-blood contact, or I'm forgetting the word, but when your disease becomes airborne, when you can transmit it through the air, is not just you can upgrade. Okay, I'm glad someone knew it. Point is, you control your disease a little indirectly, and the fact that you control your disease indirectly means you have to come up with unique strategies for how to spread your disease without all of the different countries in the world becoming so afraid of it that they do enough research to cure your disease. So one potential strategy is you can become very transmissive very quickly, but not particularly serious, like the common cold. like you're everywhere and no one really cares, so no one's really researching it all that much, and then all of a sudden the common cold becomes lethal before anyone can react to it. Another potential strategy is that you can become very, very lethal right away, but stay in an area where there is not enough money in order to research a cure. Essentially, one strategy is to become a very lethal disease like Ebola in an African nation that cannot fund its own research, but the rich countries aren't really all that concerned with what's happening in Africa. And then all of a sudden, Ebola becomes airborne and it's everywhere before the countries with money have time to react. I'm guessing people are getting a little uncomfortable as I talk about this, and that's part of the reason the game is so successful. Like, yes, it is a negative experience, but it's also a very compelling experience. So, the key to doing something like this, it does not necessarily have to get this dark, is the idea that the context of your story and the mechanics of your game do not exist in two separate bubbles. They should actively be informing each other. And for a game to be very emotionally successful like this, it needs to be very connected to the narrative context of how this works in the real world. So I'll give you a process for doing something like this. What you would do is you would actually start having a design conversation with your team of saying, like, we want to make a game about disease. What are all of the different systems that we want in our game? Maybe we want a symptoms system, or a research system, or a transmission system. What are all of the different game systems we're going to need in order to make this game work? And then what you do is you actually have to stop the design conversation for a little bit. You don't design those systems right away. And you instead take a step back and look at the human context of that system. We need to have now a human conversation about symptoms if we're going to have a symptom system. And we need to specifically pinpoint what about the idea of symptoms gets me the most emotionally invested. Is it when symptoms are gross and they're rashy and oozy and it's like, yeah, it's yucky? Is it when symptoms are scary? Is it when symptoms catch you when you're off guard, or when it's people don't die in pleasant ways? That's when I get emotionally invested, and we want to do that for all of our different systems. So once we decide when do I get the most invested in symptoms, we want to then have a conversation about the research system. When do I get the most emotionally invested in the idea of how countries spend their money and when they do it? Once we have that idea of what really gets me, like, about that one system, then we go back and we have that design conversation, and we design our system to replicate the idea that gets us the most emotionally invested. Our goal is to create gameplay systems that are emotionally meaningful by virtue of the way that they behave, not because we attached a lot of writing to it. A system like this gets me invested because it behaves like something that I care about, not because we attached a bunch of writing that got me to care about. So the idea is we have a bunch of systems that are then emotionally meaningful in and of themselves, and every time our player plays the game, those systems will react with each other in a different way and in a different order every time, because the player is going to play the game in a different time, a different way every time they play the game. And so every time the player plays the game, they will have a different emotional experience. That's a complicated idea, so I'm going to give one more example before I start taking questions. Let's say we were going to design a game around siblings, around the idea of siblings. And we decide that there's going to be a system in our game in which two object mechanics interact with each other in some way. Perfect. Now we stop the game design discussion and go, okay, what gets me emotionally invested in the idea of siblings? Is it that siblings fight? Is it that siblings help each other? Is it that they help each other when they fight? And then we design our gameplay systems to mathematically represent that idea, to behave like that idea. And then we design all of our systems to behave in a meaningful way, and the gameplay becomes emotionally meaningful without having the writing attached to it. Does that idea make sense? Cool. That is one potential goal for designing narrative context around your game. Not every game needs to be about feeling your feelings. One other potential goal is you can use the narrative context of your game to explain your gameplay systems. We, as human beings, understand human scenarios and human logic better than abstract systems of rules. So one of the ways we can, especially if we have a very complicated abstract systems of rules, we can present the player with a human scenario with logic that mimics the logic of our rules and teach the game that way. So using Forbidden Island again as an example, this is the last time I will talk about Forbidden Island, I swear to God, we'll move on to something else. One mechanic we already discussed is the idea that each different player has different movement patterns and abilities based on the character that they randomly receive at the beginning of the game. The pilot, once per turn, can fly anywhere that they want. And that makes sense to me because the idea of a pilot fits that. Like, he has access to a helicopter and he knows how to fly a helicopter, that totally makes sense. It is easier to learn and remember that mechanic than if that character was the blue character, right? It is easier for me to remember that the pilot can do that. Another example of a character that's not represented on this picture is the diver character. And the diver character has the ability to move through sunken and flooded tiles very, very quickly. That idea makes sense to me, and it's easier to learn and remember than if the diver was just the black character. This is very, let's put this into some context and think about this when compared to chess. Now, like, chess obviously did just fine for itself. Like, nobody's knocking on chess. But the narrative design of chess is a little bit flimsy in the sense that the identity of those characters doesn't help me understand their movement mechanics. Like, nothing about the idea of a bishop and, like, my human understanding of religion is like, oh yeah, infinite at diagonals. Like, perfect, got it. Nothing. It makes no sense to me that the bishop can move farther than the knight can when the knight has a horse. The movement pattern of the knight makes no sense. Because nothing about a horse is like a little bit forward and then over. Like, yes, perfect. If I was going to name a character the knight, I would name the rook the knight, because that's the movement pattern that makes the most sense to me. So even though chess is, in my mind, a simpler game than Forbidden Island is, Forbidden Island has more mechanics, has more sets of rules, Forbidden Island is actually easier for me to learn because it's presenting me with a human scenario that helps me understand the logic of the game. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. So not only can the narrative context of our gameplay systems help us understand the mechanics, help the players understand, learn, and remember the mechanics, they also make it way easier for us, the designers, to explain the game in a brief and compelling way. So this, right in front of you, is a real game. I, for the sake of showing you what I'm talking about, I'm going to try and explain it twice. First, I'm going to explain the game to you without any human understanding, without any narrative context, just the systems and the rules, and then I'm going to try it again as if I was telling you a story. So, first, just purely abstractly, this is a six-player game in which one player works by themselves against a team of five other players who are all working together. The one player working on their own is invisible. They are on the map, they know their location, but none of the other players know the location of that one player, whereas the team of five is visible at all times. Every player, both teams, moves along the map on three different sets of tracks: the yellow track, the red track, and the blue track. In order to move on a specific set, you need to turn in an appropriate colored card. So in order to move on the yellow track, you need to hand in a yellow card. Every player starts the game with a certain number of cards of each type, and no one draws cards over the course of the game, so it is entirely possible to run out of one type of card and no longer be able to use that track. Now, the invisible player is invisible for the vast majority of the game, but at specific points, at turns 3, 8, 13, and you can't see it on here, but also 18, the invisible player becomes visible for just that one turn, and everyone knows their location. All other turns, the one player is invisible. However, everyone can see the cards that the invisible player is using in order to move around the map. So the goal of the five players working as a team is to identify where the invisible player is by figuring out where they last were and what tracks they have moved on in what order since then, to figure out where they are on the map, corner them, and then win the game by having any one of the five move into the same space that the invisible player is occupying. The goal of the invisible player is to evade all of the other players until turn 20 when everyone runs out of cards and time runs out. So, probably you got most of that. Chances are, like, we could start playing right now and we have to, like, go over a couple of things again, like, in the actual game, I'm guessing. Let's try it again, like I was telling you a story, and there's human context attached. This game is called Scotland Yard. One player plays as the notorious criminal, Mr. S, whereas the other five players play as Scotland Yard. Both Mr. X and the members of Scotland Yard are moving about London using the public transportation system, the yellow taxis, the red buses, and the blue subways. In order to use the transportation system, you need the appropriate ticket. Before you can take the bus, you have to turn in a bus ticket. Now, Mr. X is hiding in the city, so he doesn't want to be found. He's invisible, but at specific points in the game, turns 3, 8, 13, and 18, Mr. X shows up on a security camera. Scotland Yard knows his location. They are also tracking him through another means. They are tracking his purchases. So Scotland Yard knows the last time Mr. X showed up on a video camera, where he was, and what he has purchased since then, what tracks he has taken. The goal of Scotland Yard is to find Mr. X, move into the same space as him, and arrest him, whereas the goal of Mr. X is to wait until 20 turns pass and his transportation arrives so he can escape London. Much easier to understand, and also a much more entertaining explanation. Without any narrative context, when your systems are complicated like this, your player's first experience with your game is, oh my god, this is so confusing. As opposed to, okay, this actually sounds like it'll be a little tiny bit of fun. Like, okay, I get to be like, all right, I can do this. Like, it's a vastly different experience. And the more complicated your systems are, the more important it is that your narrative context is working to explain those systems. Like, nobody's gonna make anything even remotely this complicated in this game jam, but imagine for me, for my own entertainment, for a moment, that you had to try and learn Civilization V without any context behind any of the systems and what they mean. That is way too complicated. There is no way to learn all of those different systems and how they relate to each other without painting it in some sort of human understanding that I can learn. Does that make sense? Cool. So, one other strategy. Isn't that great?
That's like my favorite thing.
Even when your gameplay mechanics are not doing the other things. Not every game needs to be about feeling your feelings. Maybe your gameplay systems are simple enough that you don't need your story context to explain these systems. Even under those circumstances, your story is still very important to the virality and the sales of your game. Because your story, your concept about what this game represents, is the very first thing that any potential player is going to see about your game. When I'm scrolling through the App Store and I come across Exploding Kittens, the first thing that I understand about that has nothing to do with the gameplay mechanics. It is not, oh, like that's a tightly balanced version of Russian roulette with an attack system. Like, no. I don't understand anything else about the game until I decide I am willing to devote my time to learning more about this game, to seeing whether or not I'm willing to play it. So regardless of what else your story is doing, your story is your initial pitch to your players of, hey, this is what it feels like to play my game. Don't you want to feel this? Come play my game. Let's look a little more in-depth at Exploding Kittens to see how this works. So we're going to look at a specific mechanic. These two different cards have two different narrative contexts explaining the exact same gameplay mechanic. Look at the top three cards in the deck. I will read them for you. These two See the Future cards. The top one is Feast Upon a Unicorn Enchilada and Gain Its Enchilada Powers. The second is To Rub the Belly of a Pigicorn. Now, neither of those two narrative contexts serve those other gameplay purposes. Like, neither of those makes me go, oh, enchilada powers, that's why it's three cards and not four. Like, no, that's not helping me learn how to play the game. It does also not make me emotionally invest in the mechanic. I do not have feelings now about the act of drawing three cards. Instead, the narrative context of that mechanic is emotionally appealing directly to me as the player. It's not that connected to the mechanic. It's not the connection between the two or that are important. It's the writing in and of itself that's appealing to me as a player. So, one thing that's important to understand about this is that when your story context is a little more loosely connected to your mechanics like this, when it's about appealing directly to the player, it does not last for a very long time. I can play Plague Inc. 13 different times, and on the 13th time, I will still be emotionally invested because the game is behaving in a different way that reacts to me. As opposed to by the third time I'm playing Exploding Kittens, like, I've seen the cards and they're funny, and now the gameplay mechanics have to be good enough in and of themselves for me to stick around. So mechanics are still very important to making sure that your gameplay lasts a very long time, is entertaining for a very long period of time. But your story context is what initially is going to draw players to deciding whether or not they want to learn more about your game. And it is in a large part why Angry Exploding Kittens did so well. I don't know if you guys know this. Exploding Kittens, I don't know if it still is, but when it first came out, it was the most successful Kickstarter that had ever happened. It asked for $10,000 to fund its game. By the end of the campaign, it had over $8 million. And now, it's the guy who writes the Oatmeal comics, so it's not like he had no platform for evangelizing himself, but in a large part, this game was so viral, caught so much attention, because it had an instant emotional pitch to you that was unlike what you had seen before. This is not the only game that had worked like this. Believe it or not, another game that worked the exact same way is Angry Birds. That is not the first time that game mechanic has ever appeared. A virtually identical game called Castle Crushers appeared a few months earlier. But Angry Birds was the first game to feature that gameplay mechanic and an emotional pitch that appealed to a large group of iPhone users that had not traditionally played games before, whereas a medieval theme did not. Now, the story context of Angry Birds ceases to matter very quickly, like Exploding Kittens, because it is not directly interconnected with the gameplay mechanics. Like, by level 4 of Angry Birds, you've completely forgotten that there was any story to Angry Birds. And that's okay, but in a large part, the reason Angry Birds is so successful, A, it had great gameplay mechanics, we could all still play Angry Birds, but it emotionally appealed to the right audience at the right time. So, your story can be other things. Even when you were using your gameplay mechanics to create an emotional experience like Plague Inc., even when you were using them to explain your systems like Forbidden Island, your story is always your pitch to your specific type of player that you want to try your game. Of, hey, this is what my gameplay feels like. And now you can identify that and decide whether or not you're interested. Does that make sense? Cool. So for the sake of this game jam, when you decide you want to connect a specific gameplay mechanic to the context of your story, try and make sure the explanation is accomplishing one of these three different things. Creating the emotion, explaining the systems, or directly appealing to the type of player that you want to have. In a perfect world, in the game we would have months to work on, our narrative context would do more than one of these. For the sake of this, focus on doing one and doing it really well. If you guys are interested in looking at the actual rules and the printout of Forbidden Island, you can literally type in Forbidden Island rules on Google, and the first thing that pops up is a PDF that is exactly what you get out of the box. If you guys want to look at it, that's a really great example of doing this well. Does anyone have any questions before we move on into the idea of having a plot? No. Excellent. So, the core of a plot is relatively simple. The core of a plot is somebody has a problem. And somebody has a problem tends to play out in four different steps. First, I need to see this character without their problem. And I need to do that for a very specific reason. Unless I understand a little bit about this character and what their life is like before this problem shows up, I never understand how the problem affects them. And so I never understand why the problem is important, why exactly that problem matters. So in order for the conflict of our game to have weight, I need to understand how it affected this person. I need to see a little glimpse of them beforehand. And this can be so fast. This can be a second of your character walking along the sidewalk, like, oh my god, I'm so happy. Oh my god, this is a huge problem. Like, that's fine. But I need to see a little bit of how this problem affects them before it's going to have any weight. The next step is already, we pretty much talked about it. Something happens. Now this person has a problem. Third step, we build this problem up over time to a dramatic climax. And then at the end of the climax, we resolve the problem, and shortly thereafter, our story ends. So Pixar released a list of 22 storytelling rules that are phenomenal. They came out a bunch of years ago. It flooded my inbox. Everyone was like, oh my god, you see this? Yes, I've seen it. But it was really great. And one specifically that I want to talk about is the idea of the Pixar story structure. Once upon a time, there was blank. Every day, blank. This is showing me your character. This is showing me your character before I have that problem shows up, so I can understand a little bit what their life is like. One day, blank. Something happens. Now there's a problem. Because of that, blank. Because of that, blank. We're building that problem up to the dramatic climax, and then until finally, blank, we resolve the problem, and our story ends. if we were making a 10-hour Xbox title, we would be approaching this from a far more complicated standpoint. But this is, I think, the right level of complexity for a 5 to 10 minute gameplay experience. Because remember, we still need to be able to play the game. This is not a 5 to 10 minute story. This is a story that fits inside of a 5 to 10 minute game without overwhelming the rest of the experience. So I feel like between this structure, this idea, and Pixar's 22 rules of storytelling that everyone should take a look at, you'll be okay with coming up for some sort of concept for your story. What I actually now want to talk about is how we're going to implement that story. How do we tell a story in a game, and how do we tell a story in a short game that doesn't constantly interrupt the gameplay? Now, a point that I want to make clear is under normal circumstances, we would not only be using writing to tell our story. In a normal game design situation, we would be talking about how can we use the environment arc to our advantage. How can we put into the environment what happened before the player got here? How can we use the character's art design, their animation, the music? What does it feel like to be this person in this moment? We would be having plot points happen in gameplay. You would actually be able to play out plot points in the midst of gameplay levels. That said, that all takes an awful lot of planning, and that's not plausible to do in a 24-hour period. So for the sake of this, your main tool is probably going to be writing for a couple of reasons. A, it's the easiest to make. It's the quickest to make. It is the easiest to actually implement and program into your game. And C, it's also the easiest to change if something happens. If all of a sudden tomorrow morning something goes wrong, we need to change our story, and all of our story has been placed into the environment art, we have to throw all that out and start from scratch, as opposed to going back in and changing a couple of our sentences. That's much easier to do. So most of our storytelling is probably going to happen in text for this. And that creates one big problem. A player cannot read and play the game at the same time. In order to read, their eyes need to be locked on a specific part of the screen, which means they can't get the feedback they need to actually participate in the gameplay. When our player is reading, they cannot play the game. Now, that isn't inherently toxic. Like, a player taking 7 seconds and not pressing a button in order to read a sentence or two is not the end of the world. Writing in and of itself is not bad. The problem is when too much writing happens all at once, and it's keeping people from getting back to the gameplay. It isn't the very first time text pops up and people start mashing the button. It's when, like, 3 or 4 text bubbles pop up and all of a sudden, like, nah, we need to get there. So what that means for us is we need to sort of have 2 different strategies. One, we need to break up our writing into appropriate sized bits that do not overstay their welcome, and we also need to place those bits strategically throughout our game so that they don't interrupt the gameplay. For our purposes, for a very short game, our writing has to be in very small bits. Like, a 2-minute cutscene and a 10-hour title when I'm 3 hours in is not the rest of, it's not like the apocalypse. That's not the end of the world, because I'm already a little bit invested. I can sit through 2 minutes. In a 6-minute game, a 2-minute intro is the end of the world, because I have no investment in what's happening. So we want to avoid text dumps. We want to make sure it's happening very gradually, bit by bit. We're going to talk about that second half of the strategy first, of how do we strategically place our writing. And the tool we're going to use is a design principle known as an interest curve. If you're not familiar with it, the idea of an interest curve is that in any sort of entertainment, there are going to be peaks of intensity followed by sort of cooling off periods where the audience can catch their breath. So let's look at this like it was a specific game title. This game opens, and there's a pretty big spike of intensity right away. Not necessarily difficulty, just intensity. Something flashy happens, something really interesting and fast-paced happens. That's our hook. That's what's getting players invested in the game. But we cannot keep that up forever. We cannot keep that level of intensity going over the entire experience, because A, it's impossible for us as designers to do, and B, it's not that fun for the player, because they're going to get exhausted really quickly. They're not going to be able to hold out for a very long experience. So there's a peak of intensity, but then there's also a period after that where it's like, okay, we just sort of sit back, like we let players catch their breath a bit. It can even just be a couple of seconds of like walking from one place to another, but like we need an area of our game now that isn't so demanding. And then the game tends to move through peaks of that, or through another peak, increasing over time to the climax of our game. And then after the climax of our game, there's a little bit of time where we give players to bathe in their victory before we actually end the game. Now, these natural cooling off periods are the perfect spot for writing, because this is where it's actually welcome that players aren't capable of playing the game. Writing can still entertain them, writing is still a form of entertainment, and it also does not expect anything from them. So they remain entertained while also getting a little bit of a break from the skill set of the game. A formula, you will see this very often in RPGs. A very common pattern in RPGs is like you start out a dungeon, and the dungeon gets harder over time, working up to a climactic boss battle, and then after the boss battle, that was intense, so there's a cutscene, right? A little bit of story happens after the boss battle, because you kind of need a break anyway. And then you move to the next dungeon, which is harder, and you move up to a boss fight over and over until the game ends. The idea is that you want to insert your writing where players already need a little bit of a break, and then you proportion it correctly so that it doesn't overstay its welcome. Does that idea make sense? Cool. So, now we need to talk about how we're going to actually split up our story into little tiny bits. How do you actually tell a story in tiny individual bits of text? And there is more than one way to do this. I'm going to share with you guys two different techniques that I have used before in order to do this. There are more ways to do this. You do not need to know one of these two, but I want you guys to at least have those concrete, I know how to do at least this one, when you walk out. So don't feel obligated to do this, but here's two ways in which you can break up your story into very small bits. One tool that's very useful for lighter stories is the idea of telling your story entirely through jokes. Portal was the first game to popularize this, and the idea was that Portal had a very concrete level structure. You entered a level, you solved a puzzle, Gladys told you a little bit of a joke, and then you repeated it. You entered a new level, you solved that puzzle, Gladys told you a joke again, and it created this very Pavlovian reward system that made you just want to, like, I just want to do one more level, and it looked a little funny afterwards. Like, I just want to do one more thing. And it drove you through the game. You were always going to get rewarded by something funny after you did something successful. And then Portal very cleverly stuck its story into its jokes. It started to joke about cake. It started to joke about a wonderful time you're going to have after all of these tests are done. So that by the time the story actually started, you didn't almost even realize it was happening because it was being conveyed to you through the jokes. Portal was the most popular game to do this. It was the first game to do this. If you're interested in using this technique for your game in this jam, I would look at an iPhone game called Does Not Commute that functions in virtually the same way. After every individual game played, they reward you with a little bit of a joke. School bus driver Ms. Santiago thinks the best thing about the kids being loud is that no one can hear you cry. You are now driving as Ms. Santiago. And then it will do that every couple of seconds. And in Does Not Commute, the same characters reappear over the course of the game, providing you, sort of painting you with a picture of these insane people and what their day looks like. Yes? That's a popular enough game. I think you should be able to have that. I think it should be. If it's not, we'll talk, and I'll see if I can come up with another example. That is a more comedic technique. The next one is a more dramatic technique. You're probably already familiar with it because it's become very popular in the last year. And that's the idea of, rather than telling an active story that's actually happening as the player plays the game, the story is about piecing together something that has already happened. And the reason that that's useful for breaking up small bits of text, it's easier to explain if I explain the opposite first. One of the problems with telling a story that's actively happening is that certain events take a certain amount of time in order to be believable. Like, there is no way to create an emotionally compelling death scene in under 20 seconds. Like, that's too complex of a human experience to replicate in an interesting, believable way in 20 seconds. That's going to take some time to do. And again, in a 10-hour game, a 1.5-minute cutscene is not the end of the world. We, in this case, don't want to tell our story probably in anything more than bites of at least 20 seconds is the most I'd feel comfortable going. So we can have a problem creating complex emotional events and showing them to you as they happen. They become a little too bulky. So the idea of this strategy is that individual events can be broken up into multiple bits of text, and then piecing together the story becomes kind of like a game in and of itself. The game is putting all of the tests together to figure out what happens to make things the way that they are now. A good mobile game to look at for this is Her Story, which is told primarily through 5 to 15 second video clips that are jumbled and out of order. Some of them are longer than that, that's a good example, but the most famous game to do this is the Dark Souls games by From Software. So to look at a specific example, the second bit of text here, One Fragment of Dark, having taken human shape, I'm not going to read the entire thing right now, that is a critically important event in the lore of the Dark Souls world. And I'd estimate, as a writer, if I were to make that actively happen in a game, to explain it well, make it believable, make it interesting, and provide you with all of the relevant information of the fallout from it, would probably take at least 4 minutes, I would think. But the idea is that Dark Souls doesn't tell it all at once. It broke up what already happened into different bits of text and then split it up, specifically in Dark Souls, in item descriptions, so that you only ever got a little bit of story information at a time, yet the entire story was present, and you could piece it together if you were interested after the fact. The key to doing this well is not like, oh, putting it together is a puzzle, so I'm just going to start chucking random bits of information at you in any order. That's no fun. That, to me, is the equivalent of someone dumping out a 300-piece jigsaw puzzle in front of me that has no corners and no edges, and say, here. Like, no, that's not what makes puzzles interesting. What makes puzzles interesting is that I have a place to start. Like, at a jigsaw puzzle, you start by finding the corners. You start then, after that, by going through the edges, then the easy parts of the middle, and the harder parts of the middle. It has a little bit of a difficulty curve in that it gives you an easy place to start, and then keeps adding on a little bit more and a little bit more after that. We want to design our story this way in a similar game. We want to very quickly curate an initial image of what the player thinks happened. So like looking at Bloodborne from an example, from these bits of text that you get very early on in the game, we can put together a theory on what we think happened. Like, okay, the blood is healing people, but it also does something weird to people. And there's some sort of hunt going on with, like, beasts. So is that related to the blood? Is the blood turning the people into the beasts? We can, from the first bits of information, put together a picture of what we think is already happening. That's when additional pieces become a reward. That's when I'm excited to learn more, when I already have my theory and I want to figure out whether I'm right or not. We need an initial image before this becomes an entertaining storytelling method. Now, when these stories really pop, one of the keys to doing these stories really well is to curate this initial impression and then turn it on its head, to have something, everything that they told us be true, but not the way that we think it's true. Like, I'm not going to spoil Bloodborne for you. It gets crazy. But I am going to spoil her story a little bit for you. So, in her story, the very first thing that pops up is 5 different video clips, left to right. And that curates a very specific initial image for you. Oh, it's this lady being interviewed by the police. The first interview is, oh gosh, she knew this woman, or she knew this man who got murdered, and they're trying to, like, figure out, like, did he tell you where he was going? What's happening? And by the last video, they're questioning her like they think she did it. They're like, okay, I now have enough of an initial image. I'm, like, curious about getting more pieces. That story doesn't become interesting, really interesting to me, until about 20, 30 minutes in, when I come across a video clip that makes me realize, oh my god, this woman is two people. She has a split personality disorder, and the police don't know which one of her killed this guy. That's when that becomes interesting, when everything you told me was true, but not in the way that I expected it to be true. You curated an initial image, you created a bunch of expectations with me, and then you played with those expectations. Now, I'm going to teach you a specific tool. Oh my god, there's a microphone there. I'm going to teach you a specific tool that can be very useful for doing this. And the reason that I am prefacing it is it tends to be very unpopular the moment that I reveal what it is. So I am going to ask you guys to keep an open mind temporarily. If you disagree with me at the end, that's fine. We do not need to be a hive mind that all thinks the same way, because then we would all make the same game, and that's so fun. But I'm going to ask that you wait until I'm done talking before you make up your mind of whether you disagree with me or not, because it's probably not going exactly where you expect it to. One very useful tool for telling a story this way and telling it very quickly is the use of storytelling cliches and stereotypes for a specific reason. A, when a stereotype comes up, I get a little bit guarded. like, when we are going through a fantasy story and you tell me this character you're about to meet is an elf, there's a part of it that's like, okay, it's elves. Like, okay, I can do elves. I can do this. I like Dragon Age. I like Lord of the Rings. I can do elves. I don't inherently write it off because I still like some stories that use cliches, but I instantly become guarded, and that is something we need to know about. I am waiting for you to screw up. But storytelling cliches are also useful because they get you to assume an awful lot of information that I never have to explicitly tell you. Like when I say this character is an elf, like you're a little guarded, but you're also like, okay, so like he lives a long time, he can use with nature, he's good with bows, and he's graceful, and probably a good guy, and all of this stuff that I never actually told you. I'm getting you as a player to make assumptions, and a creative storyteller can use your assumptions to their advantage. As opposed to if you were creating a fantasy story and you're like, this next character is a glurp block, like that, no. Like, you have to now stop your gameplay dead in its tracks and info dump to me what that means, because I have no way of knowing all of this detail. So it's useful for getting people to assume a lot of information very quickly. It is useful for curating that initial image in lightning speed. So, like, let's say I was making a game in this scenario where it's going to be like a 5 to 10 minute game. I'm telling my story this way and piecing together something that already happened. Maybe the first bit of text that I give to the player is there was a handsome knight who was in love with the princess of his kingdom whom he'd never met. Maybe the second piece of text that I give you is one day the princess was whisked away by a dragon, and every night since, the dragon has come back to attack the town. So the handsome knight went off to slay the dragon and rescue the woman he loves. Now at this point, you're probably like, okay, you're probably waiting for me to screw up a little bit, but I've also curated an image with you. You now think you know what happens, how it happened, and how it all turned out. And I can use that to play with your expectations very, very quickly. I can use the third bit of text to say what the handsome knight did not know is that the dragon and the princess were one and the same. I was able to curate an image for you and turn it on you and make it interesting much faster than Bloodborne or Her Story was, because they were using unique ideas they had to explain, and I was using ideas that you were familiar with. So this technique is dangerous a little bit, because once you reveal you're using these cliches and stereotypes, the player is waiting for an excuse to lose faith in you. It becomes kind of like a race. How quickly can I set this up and turn it on you before you lose faith in me as a storyteller? I equate it to playing with fire. If you do it right, you can get fireworks. If you do it wrong, you can burn your hand off. So, it is a dangerous tool. You can disagree with me that no one should ever do this. You can choose to agree with me and not do it for your game. That's fine, but it can be very useful in telling stories very quickly. So I wanted you guys to be aware of it. Cool. That is what I have for you guys today. I will be hanging out here until probably around 6 when I need to go back and let my dog out, and I don't think I'm going to be able to make it tomorrow. So if you want me to look at something, if you want to ask me questions, I'll hang around here until then. Yes? With gameplay that actually worked? I mean, it's interesting because most games don't take it far enough from my perspective. A lot of games, like as an example, I mentioned Dragon Age games, they will use those tropes and they'll put a small enough spin on it that it's interesting to me. Like with the idea of elves, they instead switched it to the idea that the elves used to be this great thing and now they're essentially slaves. So there is a little bit of a twist on it. There's enough of a twist that it feels like this fully fleshed out world, because they're getting you to assume all this information about elves that they don't have to write, but it still feels fresh enough. My personal, like, my instinct as a writer is I want to take that further. I want to propose something to you and then take it in the exact opposite of the way you expect. And I feel like there isn't too many things that did that well. The world of Fable was interesting in some ways. That those are not games where the mechanics worked, unfortunately, but the world did some interesting ways. It got dark in some areas that were unexpected and that I liked. But I feel like that's the best example I can come up with for what I'm personally talking about. You had a question.
Oh, right. I was going to ask if you have any contact information that you want to share with us.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can write it up really quickly. The best way to reach me is...
Thank you.
Yeah, no.
I know I'm going to have questions.
That is totally okay. Feel free to email me with any questions you have. I need to remember to erase this before the next person starts. This is my business, and I have a contact form on there. I also have a newsletter and other resources on there. Eventually, I will post a video of this exact thing we're streaming to Twitch and recording. So there will actually be a video of this up on the resources page on my website in the next couple of days if you guys want to look at it. Someone had a question? No. Any other questions? You can also find me throughout the day. Looks like we're settled.
Are you on Twitter?
I am not on Twitter. I mean, I have a Twitter, but I just never use it, so it's useless for you.
Yeah, no problem.